Welcome to the Jonah Carey Podcast, friends. Thank you so much for tuning in. Hey, we've got a change of pace today. Today's guest is Gail Gand. Gail Gand, a two-time James Beard Award-winning pastry chef, longtime host on the Food Network, and a very interesting person. I got a chance to hang out with Gail in Cooperstown and chat with her at length about making it as a high-level pastry chef, which is not easy to do in the male-dominated world of kitchens and all that good stuff. Really, really interesting stuff. Everything from the politics of being in a high-level kitchen to the restaurant business, which is hard and fraught and weird and challenging, and pastries. And then she baked pastries over the weekend. So I ate a bunch of them, which was good. Thanks to the Katz family for hosting us and to Gail and Jimmy for being really cool and everybody else. And this was neat. It was Gail is a newer pal, and so it was very neat to kind of get to know her a little bit better and hopefully share that conversation with you. I think this is the second time I've had a chef type of person on. Had one back when I did one, was it like 2016 or so? And that was an interesting chat too, and everybody eats food. And I have a sweet tooth, so I'm always up for chats about desserts. And I hope that you enjoy this one very much, too. And that was a great weekend in Cooperstown, the second of the two Cooperstown podcasts, the first one being with John Thorne. If you haven't listened to that one, what the hell are you waiting for? Go listen to it. That was last week, and that was really, really good. Thorne is a legend, and he's phenomenal. So do all that. Hey, lots of sponsors this week, which is good. We got to pay the bills. Let's start with ZipRecruiter. Listen, ZipRecruiter, fantastic. Hiring is a pain in the ass, but ZipRecruiter makes it easy. You go to ZipRecruiter.com/Jonah, and you will be able to connect and make it work. Find the candidates that you need to fill the jobs that are available. It is fantastic. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. Powerful matching technology allows ZipRecruiter to scan thousands of resumes, find people with the right experience, and invite them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one, spotlights the top candidates, so you never miss a great match. So effective that 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. With results like that, it's no wonder that ZipRecruiter is the highest rated hiring site in America. And right now, listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free by going to the following URL. That is ZipRecruiter.com/Jonah. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Jonah. And you know what? We'll do one more time. ZipRecruiter.com/Jonah, because there's nothing more entertaining than spelling on a podcast. ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire. Thank you to ZipRecruiter for sponsoring the podcast. Hey, we got some programming notes. So CBS Sports, if you are not watching CBS HQ, what the hell is wrong with you? There is no sport that is beyond the reach of CBS HQ. Are you fired up for the stretch run of baseball? You know what? You can see my smiling face talking about baseball in all its forms 75 million times a day, in the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening, late at night, constantly bombarding you with information about baseball. Get on that. But if you're into college football, we got that going. We got a really great college football crew over at CBS. NFL is coming up. If you're into that, that's good. You want NBA hot stove, that's cool. Anything that you could possibly imagine, go to cbssports.com/HQ. And you can watch live that way. Or do it through the CBS Sports app, which is really cool. If you've got an Apple TV or a Roku or anything like that, just punch up the CBS Sports app and you can turn it on 24 hours a day. News and analysis, really, really cool. I love my job. It's really great. And I hope you do too. Well, love me on my job. I don't know, something like that. Anyway, do all of that. Here comes another sponsor, friends. That is Quip. Quip is fantastic. The truth is that most of us are brushing our teeth wrong, not for long enough, and forget to brush our teeth on time. That's because most brands focus on selling flashy gimmicks rather than better brushing, but not Quip. What makes Quip so different? First of all, I am using Quip now, and it is freaking great. A terrific electric toothbrush, fraction of the cost of bulkier brushes, and it works really well. We all stink at brushing. I'm going to do it in 10 seconds and run out the door or whatever. You know what? Good teeth are important. You don't want cavities. You don't want root canals. It stinks. So use Quip. Packs just the right amount of vibrations to help clean your teeth. It's got a built-in timer, again, which I use, so that I clean for the dentist. Recommended 2 minutes with guiding pulses that remind you when to switch sides. And the subscription plans are for your health, not just your convenience. new brush heads on dentist recommended schedule. So every 3 months for just $5, you get new heads, and you can include that with free shipping worldwide. So how about that? Backed by a network of more than 20,000 dentists and hygienists and hundreds of thousands of happy brushers who use Quip every day. Quip starts at just $25. So you go to getquip.com/Jonah and you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/Jonah. That's getquip.com/Jonah. Thank you to Quip for sponsoring the podcast. You will be listening to this on Wednesday. On Thursday, you will see my new work at sportsnet.ca. I've got a piece coming out about managers. There's some speculation as to what might happen with John Gibbons, despite the preeminent hashtag Gibby the best. Maybe Gibby not the best in the eyes of management. I don't know. It's hard to say. I think they kind of dealt him a bad hand, but that's neither here nor there. Well, maybe it is here nor there because managers get scapegoated for things, and really talent tends to win out more than anything. But yeah. I will weigh in on managers. You'll see that on sportsnet.ca on Thursday. And also catch me on Blue Jay Central, which should be about 6:40 p.m. Eastern time Thursday evening on Sportsnet as well. So, yeah, lots of Blue Jays content there. And we have one more sponsor, and that is Lightstream. If you're thinking about saving money this summer, why not start by paying less interest on your credit card balances? You can refinance with a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream. Listen, it's an easy way to save hundreds to thousands of dollars and lower your interest rate. Lightstream offers credit card consolidation loans from 5.89% APR with auto pay. And compare that to credit cards. It might be 18%, might be 20 or whatever. Credit cards will murder you. They are evil and terrible. And Lightstream is neither of those things. They're great. You can get your funds as soon as the day you apply. Lightstream believes that people with good credit deserve a great interest rate and no fees. So say goodbye to high interest credit cards. This summer, start saving with Lightstream. Listeners of the Jonah Carey Podcast, and save even more with an additional interest rate discount on top of Lightstream's already low rates. Only way to do this is go to lightstream.com/Jonah. That's lightstream.com/Jonah. Get on this, friends. You've got debt. It sucks. Lightstream's going to help you out. The disclaimer, subject to credit approval, rate includes 0.5% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com for more information, and thank you to Lightstream for sponsoring the podcast. This is a very, very long intro, so go enjoy this amazing podcast. I hope it was worth your while to wait on it. It's Gail Gand. She's really cool. You will want to eat lots of whatever, cakes, macaron, whatever it is you like, so enjoy. The conversation is that there's no like interview style. We're jumping into it, and you're talking about the ukulele and
tenor ukulele specifically, which is a bigger size uke, so it's got a bolder sound.
So when you pick up an instrument when you're a small child, how do you know I definitely want to play the tenor ukulele as opposed to the tuba or whatever? You were little when you started, right?
I was little. I was 6 years old when I started playing guitar, but it was because my dad taught guitar.
Okay.
So that was the instrument that was around the house to play, and I could sit in on his lessons. My job was to sharpen the pencils before every lesson and put them on the music stands. So, you know, at some point I'm like, I need some payback for doing this, and so he traded me lessons for manual labor as a 6-year-old child.
So percussion was out of the question. What if you wanted to be the drummer?
You know, we didn't have a drum set in the house at that point. I have one in my house now.
Okay.
Because two of my three kids play drums.
Is that right?
Yeah. So I don't actually have a living room. Like, my friends are always like mad at me because I don't have a couch and I don't have furniture because my living room is all, like, a piano, there's a cello, there's a drum set, a drum kit, which, you know, takes up a lot of space. And then myriad guitars and regular size ukes. I have a Martin regular size uke that's really cool from my husband that was a birthday present.
Wow.
So there's just instruments everywhere instead of actual furniture that you can sit on.
Do you think people are born musical?
I know my dad thought that everybody had a musical ability.
Okay.
There's definitely been people I've met who have disproved that theory. So I don't know, but I do think that there's sort of like a genetic predisposition to it, or like I kind of feel music in me,
okay,
which is a little embarrassing because like I break into song and want to always sing along with stuff.
Nice.
And it's not, you know, what I notice a lot of other people are doing.
Right.
So I know that I have some sort of need to have music around me in a more intense way than most people do.
But how do you know if that's nature or nurture if you were in such a musical environment?
Yeah, I don't know how you know. I mean, my brother's a professional musician
as
well.
I guess, would he have been a professional musician if your dad was an accountant?
Hard to know.
Yeah.
I don't know how you would know that. And all kids, you know, you find out like film directors like Sofia Coppola, you know,
she grew
up with her dad. So I do think, you know, there's like a half a cup of what your parents did for a living and a half a cup of what you're good at. And that equals what you do.
It's one thing to take lessons and try to master your instruments. Another thing to, okay, this is now your, well, kind of living, but you're a child and going out on the road and doing these things. Is there a meta awareness at that point, or is it just, well, this is the only life that I have? I'm 8 or 9 or whatever, but I'm just doing it. Or are you taking a step back and saying, well, my friends are playing in the park and I'm, we talked about this, at Expo 67 or whatever, doing something that just is not a typical thing for a child to do.
Well, I knew my family didn't take ski vacations
like
my friends did.
Right.
And I, like, never wore a white ski jacket. I remember being really cognizant of that. Like, I didn't own one of those puffy white ski jackets that had the tags hanging out.
Yeah.
So I knew that our vacations were really different because anytime we took a vacation, we would always be performing somewhere with the Gann Family Singers. And that way my dad could write the trip off is what he told us. That was like the excuse. But my dad was just always looking for anywhere to perform and any reason, whether he got paid or didn't get paid.
Yeah.
He needed music around him and wanted to be playing music all the time. So we sort of were in the glow of that, I guess. The thing that amazes me, I've had 6-year-olds.
Yeah.
Right? And or like when I was playing at Expo 67, I'm in fifth grade, and I think of my kids when they were in fifth grade and parading them across the country and getting them to go up on stage and getting them to like do their introduction and come in, you know, on the fifth bar and sing this harmony. Like my kids wouldn't be able to do that at all. And I'm amazed that my father was able to get us to do it and that we could do it.
Yeah.
Because I taught guitar in high school to all, you know, different ages of people. And I'm not trying to say like, oh, I was an exceptional fifth grader, but I can't believe my dad got us to do what we did so well.
Yeah.
I don't know how he was able to, or if we were just, you know, so
predisposed
suited
to it.
For
yeah.
it. Yeah. But looking back, that was the part that really amazes me of like I can barely get my kids to get in the car, you know, and comb their hair. It's like, how did he get us to play Simple Gifts on the dulcimer and then take a solo and, you know, and like Expo 67,
when I
did some of the introductions to the songs and I had to learn my intros in French as well.
Oh.
And it was probably like bad phonetic French that my dad, you know, there wasn't Google Translate.
Yeah,
so he probably looked up word by word, which doesn't necessarily mean that's how you say it in a sentence. But then I had to memorize that also. Like the idea of getting my 7th graders now to do that, I don't think it could happen. It wouldn't happen. So I wish I could ask him, like, how'd you crack that code? Because that was pretty fascinating.
That's an interesting parenting dilemma, too, because on the one hand, like languages, for instance, we have a friend whose kid speaks so many languages, and apparently up until age 5 you can retain a lot. He seems particularly predisposed, and he's working on Cyrillic. And he's this little child. And children, theoretically, have a lot of mental capacity. There's a lot of... society puts blocks on what you can do, but when you're younger, you are actually capable of a lot. So on the one hand, it's, well, why don't we find out if my kid is a virtuoso, or this or that. On the other hand, it's, I could also just have my kid go outside and scrape their knees and do whatever. And both of these things have merits. It's cool to push a child and to see what is the full limit of their potential. But on the other hand, it's like, well, maybe, to use a cliche, you let the kids be kids. So I'm wondering from your perspective as the child at that time, like, I imagine you had fun doing this stuff, but was it like, I'm missing out? Like, the ski vacations you missed out, but was it... you know, was there a worry? Like, you obviously didn't choose to parent your children that way. You said, you want to do this? You want to dye your hair this way? You want to go to... fine, I don't care. I'm going to be this way. Whereas, you know, your family had a particular idea of what it was that you were going to be doing, at least at that age.
Yeah, there was a... you know, it seemed like there was a design. You know, it was Grand Family Singers by design.
Yeah.
So that my dad could perform and play music, but also include his family in it. The funny thing, I mean, the way the whole thing started was my mom asked for a guitar for her birthday.
Mm-hmm.
My dad had been a classic jazz trumpet player in college. Okay. He had like a big band. They played parties and dances, and mm-hmm. that was part of how he made money in college. And so he was a musician at heart,
yeah.
Played, you know, that's what he did in the army. He played the trumpet, and, you know, he was the guy that blew reveille in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So he's a musician, but, you know, goes to college, gets a white-collar job, yeah. Has kids, marries my mom. And when, I don't know what birthday it would have been, but when I was 5 or 6, my mom, for her birthday, asked for a guitar.
Mm.
And this is, you know, like 1962, and my dad is just like he can barely hold his excitement. He's like, oh my God, you know, Myrna wants a guitar. This is so great. And uh-huh. he goes out and buys her this Stella guitar, I remember. And it was like fake sunburst, you know, and gives it to her for her birthday. And she's like, oh my God, thank you so much. This is exactly what I wanted. This is exactly what I asked for. And then she turns around and she hangs it on the wall above the couch. As a piece of art.
Oh.
And she liked how guitars looked. It wasn't to play it. And yeah. My poor dad is like, oh. Like, yeah, I was so close to my wife, you know, taking up an instrument. And he stared at it for a couple weeks on the wall. And then he took it down. And he decided he was going to learn how to play it.
Mm.
So he starts taking guitar lessons at the Old Town School of Folk Music in Chicago. And the neighbors kind of got wind that he was learning how to play, you know, this land is your land, and said, can you teach us?
Mm-hmm.
And my dad's like, well, sure, you know, we can have a group lesson. And yeah. There were like 6 neighbors, and they all wanted to learn how to play guitar for my dad. And my dad was basically like 8 lessons ahead of his students.
Right, yeah.
Always.
Yeah.
So all he had to do was be like, you know, no, 8 weeks more.
I know these 3 chords, sure.
And then I can teach you.
Yeah.
And that was sort of how the whole thing started. And so I actually have sort of an attitude of, like, the lemon angel pie that I made last
so
night.
Good.
I was about to teach that in a class a few weeks ago and then realized, oh, I've never made it before. I probably should make it once before I teach others.
That's cool, though.
You know, it's like, put on your seatbelt first, then assist others.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I have this idea that, you know, sort of you can learn things quickly and assimilate the knowledge and then be able to pass it on in a valuable way, definitely. And, you know, in the restaurant business in general, you know, you're always sort of on call. I remember my chef came to me, so this is early in my career. It's like in the 80s. I'm mm-hmm. working in Rochester, New York at a hotel. It's called the Strathallan Hotel. And my chef is Greg Broman. And Greg comes to me. I'm his pastry chef at the time, and says, Gail, can you make croissants? And I say, oh, of course, chef. And he's like, okay, great. I think I might need you to do some tomorrow. I had never done any at the hotel there. I had never done any in my life.
But you don't say no.
But you don't say no. I said, yes. I go home that night. I make 9 different recipes of croissants. I stay up all night,
mm-hmm.
and I teach myself how to make them. And the next morning when I get there and Chef Greg Broman says, oh, those croissants I said I was going to need, I'm going to need them. You know, can you pull that off for me? I'm like, absolutely, chef, no problem. And now I know it. But when I said yes, I didn't know it.
Hmm.
But what I did know is that I come through for myself and I can count on myself to learn things if I need to.
That's a very no fear kind of attitude though, because I think that we all have psychological blocks. And, I mean, I'll tell a slightly personal story. I remember Amy and I, you know, went up north one weekend and I was like, I can't build a fire. And she said, sure you can. And I built an amazing fire. It was this roaring fire. It was nothing. Everybody can build a fire. But I was like, oh, of course I can. But you had this.
I have the opposite.
And you have such funny, a can-do attitude.
My husband knows this.
Yeah.
And kind of uses it for evil, not for good. Like he'll go, he would say.
Who's the softest, sweetest, nicest man ever? Yeah.
And he'd say, I bet you can't build a fire, right? And he'll say that I can't, and I'm like, oh, yeah, well, watch me. Yeah, and I've got this real, like, oh, yeah, you can't make me stop, you know, watch me do this.
Yeah.
So if you dare me, like, tell me I can't do something, I naturally want to do it. You know, it's probably something I got from my dad. He was a very determined guy.
Yeah.
Who, you know, he came from kind of a lower middle class family, fairly uneducated from sort of central southern Illinois. And he was determined to... You know, not let, his dad was a coal salesman.
Mm.
His mom, you know, smoked Lucky Strike non-filters and drank Coca-Cola and, you know, made excellent fried chicken, I must say. But, you know, not a really sophisticated family.
Yeah.
And he decided, you know, he wanted to do better in life. So he's at college. He finds this nice Jewish girl, my mom, marries her and, just, you know, does better than the generation before
him,
which is kind of what in America we do, or we're supposed to do. We're sort of stuck right now, but
yeah. Can you teach that kind of drive, can-do attitude? You have three children. Is that doable, or is there, again, nature versus nurture?
No, I think you can. And, you know, I have twins, so I do the nature-nurture experiment every day, and it's most of my conclusion is it's nature.
Okay.
You know, I have two girls. One's like super outgoing and ready for her close up and just, you know, a character and tons of confidence. And the other one, she did a report in school a couple weeks ago about low self-esteem and how hard it is to have that. She's kind of shy. She's reserved.
That's very interesting to have the confidence to talk about it, though. That's
so, yes, I should have pointed that out. How low is your self-esteem?
That's pretty great, actually, in some ways.
But it's
bad,
like,
but great.
Yeah, she's shy, and you know, Ruby's got like an agent, and you know, goes to auditions. Ella could never do that.
Yeah.
And I convinced myself, you know, if something made Ruby, you know, we used to call it bossy, but now we call it leadership qualities, right? You know, if something we did made Ruby have leadership qualities, they both would have it, you know, or if something we did made Ella shy, they both would be that way. So they were kind of that way in utero, to be perfectly honest, which Jimmy, you know, he's always like, you can, no. I'm like, you wait till they come out.
Wow.
This one's trouble. And this one's like a Buddha angel. Like you can almost see the halo over her head. So, so a lot of it is nature. Having said that, I've had a bunch of interns. You know, my girls are not fully formed, so I don't know yet.
Yeah.
My son's 22, so he's like mostly there, but like one of my interns, Jess, came to me when she was about 14 and working in the kitchen with me and doing performances and being on stage
that's
and
young.
Traveling and,
wow.
She kind of knew early that that's what she wanted to do. And she was sort of like skipping school a little and, and because she heard me talk so much and give so many, you know, I do keynote speaking and I do stand up and I also do cooking demonstrations, like the whole thing. She heard me say those ideas a couple times of like, you know what, if your chef asks you to do something and you don't know how to do it, just say you do anyway and then go home and learn it. And then she'll call me. She's on a cruise ships right now for Holland America. For America's Test Kitchen, she'll like send me an instant message or, you know, call me and say like, you know, that thing you say about like, you don't know how to do something. And then like that night she goes, I did it. And it worked. So
that's such a cool, empowering feeling.
It's
the best.
Well, you feel heard and you feel like, oh, okay, so it really works.
Yeah.
And you can, you know, help someone have more fun in their lives.
For sure.
Yeah. So some of it can be taught, but like, stay tuned and check back in, you know, maybe 7 or 8 years to see if the girls got any of that.
But, see, I'm wondering about going into your profession then? Because I assume if you talk to most, well, a lot of chefs, they might say, well, you know, I grew up cooking and like messing around in the kitchen with my mom, and then I figured I'd give it a shot or whatever. But I'm wondering, you know, whatever, if those are the origins or not, but if it was like by 13, 14, you're like, oh, I'm definitely going to be a James Beard Award winning dessert. Like if it was that extent, because
not
you felt,
at all.
So despite the fact that you had this great inner confidence, you did not envision that the trajectory of your career would be that upward.
I was supposed to be a professional musician.
Right.
I had a bone spur on my finger as a kid, and my parents had surgery to have it removed because my dad said, you know, someday you're going to be on television as a musician and you're going to be playing classical guitar and there's going to be a close up of your hand and they're going to see that bone spur. So
this is like you being a pitcher almost.
We're going to have this taken off
because
you're going to want that removed.
Uh-huh.
Now, the irony is I do end up with my hands on television in close-ups, but not doing music. It was cooking.
Yeah.
So I was not destined for this at all. And, you know, you got to think about when this is. I'm growing up in the 60s and 70s.
There's no celebrity chefs.
I go off to, you know, art school to actually be a silver and goldsmith is what I studied.
Which is amazing, too, yeah.
Well, it's the same sort of manual dexterity that pastry requires and that playing an instrument requires.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of my love is making stuff.
Yep.
You know, making jewelry and setting stones and adorning people. And then when I go to college, I'm also like making vases and, you know, raising silver and find out it's this very sort of flexible, fluid material, which is weird to say about metal, but that's what you learn, you come to know when you're
a metalsmith.
It's like
a throwback kind of trade almost.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Paul Revere.
Yeah, right.
All that. And George Jensen, who's the Scandinavian guy that helped us. So anyway, while I'm in art school, though, I start working in restaurants. Like, what do you do as a starving art student? You waitress. And I give great waitress. Like, I love, you know, because I can connect with people.
Yeah.
I mean, I was on stage as a kid talking to 200 strangers
at
a gig, and I know how to... And I feel comfortable doing that at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I love sort of describing the food and helping nurture people and restore people back to their, you know, that's what the word restaurant comes from. That's a French verb.
Yeah.
What's the French verb for restore?
Restaurant, I think.
That's what the word restaurant comes from and what it means. And
I've never thought about
what
that.
It's for. It's to restore you back to like your best self. So I took that really seriously as a waitress that was my job.
Mm-hmm.
And then one night, a very typical thing happened, which is a line cook doesn't show up, does a no show, no call. And, you know, it's 5 o'clock and my manager's like, damn, you know, Chuck's not here. Gail, can you cook? And I'm like, no, I can't cook. I'm from the North Shore of Chicago. You know, we make reservations. And she gets an apron and she throws it at me and she says, you can cook now. Get in the kitchen.
Wow.
And I had never, I'm 19, I'd never cooked professionally.
This is a high-end restaurant?
It's not. It's
okay.
A vegetarian restaurant.
Okay.
It was called Light of Yoga. And it was like half bookstore, half restaurant.
Oh,
and I
amazing.
Worked there because I was a vegetarian at the time.
Okay.
It was the only place in town I could eat. And what actually had happened was I would go there and eat and I would play Beat the Check. Do you know that game?
No.
So you go in, you sit down, you have dinner, you... ask for the check, and then you get up to go to the bathroom, and you never come back.
You dine and dash. I've heard dine and dash.
Okay. Right, I call it beat the check.
Yeah.
So I
make that joke.
I did that
all the time.
Like 3 times, and after the third time, I was like, oh my God, I got to stop doing this. Like, I'm going to get caught.
Yeah, yeah.
I know. If I get a job here, I'll get family meal.
Very pragmatic.
So you get free food.
Yep.
That's sort of the deal in the restaurant, is there's not a lot of upsides, but you get free dinner.
Yep.
And so I applied as a waitress. Because I could eat there. I got $2 worth of free food every day. I would eat a $1.25 salad.
Mm-hmm.
And I would invite my boyfriend up and he would have a 75-cent carob sundae. So I'd feed the whole family.
Carob sundae.
Carob, right? So, I get thrown in the kitchen right that night that the line cook doesn't show up. And I'm terrified. I've never done this professionally. I made pies with my mother.
Yep.
I baked with my Hungarian grandmother.
Which, amazing.
But I have dyslexia. So when I would bake with my mom, I would screw things up.
Wow.
And my lovely mother, instead of saying like, oh, Gay, you screwed it up again, she'd go, oh, look, Gay, you invented something new.
Oh, wow.
Like, she didn't make me feel bad about it.
It's wonderful.
And sort of, you know, helped me see it as like, maybe it's a jumping off point for something creative rather than a messing up thing.
Yeah.
So anyway, so I get in the kitchen. I'm completely terrified for about 6 seconds. I'm just like, don't even know what, like I almost go white, you know, and don't know what I'm looking at. And then at like second number seven, I get choked up every time I talk about it. I feel this sense of calm come over me.
Cool.
Like I had found my home.
Oh, wow.
And I don't know if you've ever had that. It's like I felt like I was speaking a language I was completely fluent in, but I don't remember learning it. And it was like I found where I belonged at 19, which is like super lucky. You know,
7 seconds in.
I have a 20, yeah, 7 seconds into it. Looking back, well, like one of my theories is it must have sort of been the waitress in me would describe each dish to the line cook, Gail, of like, oh, that's the grilled cheese sandwich with the tomato and oregano in it, because I would have to describe the food to the guests of what's got sesame oil and what's steamed and what's fried. And, you know, I knew all about the food, so I just kind of talked the description to myself and did that, and it all came out. And I was so excited and... you know, it was like a calling almost. And I ran home that night after work and I called my parents and I said, I figured out what I want to do. I want to be a chef. So at 19, I know. My dad drops the phone. My mom kind of goes silent.
This is not the era of celebrity chefs.
No, this is like 1975.
No.
You know,
Julia Child, that's
Wolfgang it. Wolfgang Puck had not legitimized us yet. No. My dad picks up the phone and he goes, well, Gay, I guess everybody's got to eat.
It's true.
You know, and my 19-year-old self is like, really? Really? Like, that's the supportive thing you're saying? You're like, God. Yeah. And I said, that's what you've got to say? And he goes, well, you know, it's not a very reliable business. I said, Dad, you're a folk singer. He goes, and a jazz trumpet player.
And a philosophy professor on the side, yes, right?
That makes a difference. So, I mean, I understand his fear was, you know, I was going into a career that was male-dominated, that
for
was
sure.
a lot of hours. It's, you know, he pictures, like, sweaty, short-order cook, you know, with a cigarette and a bottle of brandy on the top shelf, and, like, that's the world I'm entering.
Mm-hmm.
But in my mind, I knew it was a fine art. I knew that I'm studying fine arts at the time, which sort of involves maybe four, you know, 3 to 4 of your senses, if you're lucky, if you've got an interesting enough medium you're working in, but certainly not all 5 senses. But food does.
Yeah.
Food really does. And in my mind, it was a finer art than fine art was.
Mm.
Just, I didn't know how to express that, and I, you know, nobody got that yet. I did. I knew it was coming, but I couldn't really convince people of that. So the funny thing is, you know, I was completely offended by what my dad said. Well, Gay, everyone's got to eat.
Yeah.
As if that's the only reason I'm doing it. But there's that funny thing where, like, as you get older, your parents get smarter. So I thought about later, I was like, well, you know, he's actually kind of right in the sense that, you know, you can live without music, you can even live without visual art, but you literally cannot live without food. It's something that is essential to life.
Yes.
Everyone does have to eat. And I was like, ooh, maybe you meant it in like this, you know, Buddhist kind of way that I've picked this field that, you know, is essential to life and is a, you know, you can't be without it. Yep. And so... he's absolutely right. Everyone does have to eat. And it might not have been such an awful thing to say. I'm not sure he meant it that way.
Yeah, well, you can interpret it however.
We'll never know. Yeah, so it did take me a while to come to terms with admitting that I loved cooking so much that that's what I was going to do. So I had to... my other after-school job was... I was a strolling balladeer at a restaurant in Cleveland, Ohio. It was this, like... it was called the James Tavern. It was sort of a Williamsburg style. So I like walked around in a bustier and a granny cap and sang like Irish and English folk songs.
Oh my God.
You know, singing like the Irish Rover and hoping for a lousy $5 tip. But I get paid like $100 a night, which is not bad money for a 19 year old. So, and the funny thing, so I played at the one in Cleveland like every Tuesday night. And my dad played it. There was one in Chicago also. And he played there. And when I came home for Christmas break, I remember that year, he had booked me into the James Tavern
mm.
so he could have like a week off. No. Like, he made me work it. He's like, oh, by the way, while you're home, you know, you brought your Bold Sultry with you, right? Because I booked you in for, you know, every other night at the wow. James Tavern. I'm like, thanks, Dad. Thanks a lot. So I had to retire from that.
And take your new profession seriously.
Right. And I also had a dad who really needed a daughter who had a college degree.
Okay.
Like one of his goals.
Where'd you go to school?
The Cleveland Institute of Art.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So CIA, which yeah. is kind of funny because the culinary school yes. in America is CIA also, the Culinary Institute.
Yes.
So I tell people I went to CIA and they're like, oh, you know, the 2-year or the 4-year, you know, like,
no.
who are your chefs? I'm like, no, I'm the Cleveland Institute of Art. But he just, one of his goals was to have college graduate kids.
Okay.
And my brother actually dropped out of high school to be a musician and didn't go to college. So, like, it's all on me.
Yeah.
So he told me, you know, if I don't graduate college, no one will ever marry me, which is so funny because I've been married 3 times now. But I did graduate college.
Also, the previous generation, I feel like there was a bias against it. You're too educated and maybe men will be afraid of you. Like, if you go back to the 40s or whatever, I feel like that actually could be black. Feels like that way.
That's
I don't know.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I know for my mom, she felt super trapped in her sort of like 1950s life and
yeah.
was the original feminist. She...
Huh.
Like, when I was in 8th grade, we had to take typing, and she told me to flunk typing.
Because it was too home-ecky.
I'm like, what? You want me to what? She's like, I want you to flunk typing. I'm like, why would I do that? She goes, no daughter of mine's going to be someone's secretary.
Wow.
So, that's like 1969.
Cool mom.
You know. But trap, you know, she...
Yeah.
I mean, she was trying to give me some tools that she wasn't given.
Yeah.
So I had to retire from music. I had to finish my degree in college so my dad would be happy.
Uh-huh.
And so it's not till I'm like 27 that I like give myself a gift for my 27th birthday and allow myself to do this thing that I love doing.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, at the time I didn't know if it was sustainable or if I would tire of it. I'm 61 now, so... It turns out it was a really good idea, and I still love it, and I'm still interested, and
yep.
I still am learning and reading and teaching. But I just love thinking back on my 27-year-old self. Like, thank God I was honest with myself and allowed myself to give myself this gift of doing something that my family was not supportive of. You know, my brother was like, oh, you know, what are we going to do when Gail needs to be supported because she's going to fail at that?
So as a guy who's a professional musician, right. I mean, right. it worked out, but still.
Well, and then there's this weird, you know, and this is just sort of a parenting thing. There's this weird double edge of like, so did I achieve so much in my career because everyone thought I couldn't? Like, what if that's what motivates people?
But everybody has their own thing. That could work for you. It might not work for this
yeah,
guy.
Yeah, I just, you know, I sometimes worry, like, is that why I try so hard? Because my dad could never be pleased.
Mm.
And he never really let me know that he never did, like, good job, Gay.
Yeah.
But I, like, later in my dad's life when he was in the hospital and things and for, you know, open heart surgery, I'd have to go and visit him. And the nurses would come up and they'd go, your dad is so proud of you.
Yeah.
I'd be like, that's great.
They tell other people.
Really nice if he told me.
Yeah.
You know, and that's like after I have a TV show for 10 years, like he's still
yeah,
never...
Yeah, you've made it to the max.
Yes. And so, but there's this funny thing of like, is that why I try so hard? Because he never did say good job. And maybe that's the secret to me, you know, doing well. I don't know.
So it's, you could unravel that 50 times, I feel
yes.
like.
Yes.
So you talked about the male dominated world of that. I mean, was that... You did end up starting when I assume you were a little bit more self-possessed at 27 than 19, and that's what I imagine would have given you a little bit of life experience, but it still has to be daunting, and the odds still have to be against you to a certain extent. So did you experience tangible roadblocks because of your gender? Or lack of experience, or lack of cachet, or whatever? Like,
well, I mean, I don't know if it's tangible roadblocks, but initially when Chef Greg Broman... I had worked in a couple restaurants with him that one of them closed, like, right on, like, we were working Saturday night service and, like, the mob came in and just, like, closed the
restaurant. Oh, my God.
Bought it for cash from somebody who probably owed them money.
Wow.
And we lost our jobs. And then he, like, got a job at the university club, so I followed him there
okay.
and worked with him there. And then I kind of stopped working for him and was finishing my degree.
Mm-hmm.
And... After I graduated from art school, I was making jewelry and making a living
mm-hmm.
a little lonely living in my studio all by myself, you know, trying to discover the meaning of life for about a year. And after a year, Greg Braumann comes to me and says, Gail, you know, can you help me out? I really hate my pastry chef. I want to fire him. Would you just come and like work pastry for 6 months?
Okay.
And he was sort of like, you know, you miss it. You know, you love it. And it's a real family thing working in a kitchen. You're in this little, it's like a circus family. We're all dysfunctional people. but it's a group effort. It's a team sport. It's not a, you know, you're not in your studio all by yourself trying to
figure out your life. You can't pout. You don't have time for that.
Well, and just, you've got helpers, you know, if you need them. And you, everyone's, you know, it sucks with everyone. You know, it's let's have it suck together.
Yeah.
So I kind of liked the social environment. And I liked working on a team and in a group. And so he talked me into coming back in the kitchen. And I said to him, though, like, I'm only doing it for 6 months because pastry is where you, that's where you always stick girls. You know, women always get stuck in the pastry department.
Yeah.
Or garmanger, which is salads.
Right.
So he's like, okay, here's the deal. You do this for me for 6 months, and I will let you out if you want. If you're ready to get out of pastry, I'll move you somewhere else in the kitchen.
Okay.
So after 6 months, he comes to me. He's like, okay, you know, man of my word, would you like to be on the line, or where else in the kitchen would you like to be? And I'm like, you know what? I just, there's a few more things I want to work on. I'm good for now. Can we give it another 6 months? So, you know, then it's a year. And we go through that year after year after. He comes back to me of like, how about now? I'm like, no, I'm still, you know, but you know, how dare you stick women in pastry? But, you know, let me just stay here a little bit longer. And, you know, for me, it was chemistry. It was physics. I've got some OCD, and it really, like, feeds into that because everything has to be, like, you know, precise, exact, and in order, and, you know, 1,000 truffles you're piping in little straight rows, like little soldiers. Like, it just, all of it fit me.
Yeah.
The craftsmanship that it required. You know, it wasn't like cutting up animals. That was also a plus.
Yeah.
So I ended up finding out that I had a affinity for pastry.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because occasionally I have lunch with this chef.
Yeah, still.
I'll go back to Rochester.
Yeah.
And he'll say, like, so, how about now?
That's great.
No, not quite. So, while I was working in kitchens, I did find that, you know, guys would be like, oh, do you need help lifting that? Or, you know, oh, and I'd say, you know, you'll know when I need help. Like, I got really sort of tough and mean almost. You learn to swear. You learn to hold your own. And I'm short. You know, I'm 5 feet tall. I'm not. It's hard to. So I always carry a milk crate next to me. So you learn tricks of like how to not be dependent on other people.
Yeah.
And how to be independent. Because you don't want to be the weak link in the kitchen.
Sure.
But there was also, you know, like I'd go in the cooler. Uncle Phil would follow me in. You know, molest me in the cooler. I'd deflect his advances, which he could hardly believe that I, you know, wouldn't welcome him touching me and whatever, you know, trying to kiss me and stuff. And I remember the last time it happened, he flew out of the cooler screaming, she's a lesbian! She's a fucking lesbian! Because the only reasonable, you know, explanation for why I was deflecting his advances is I must be a lesbian.
Yeah.
Otherwise I would want it. So, you know, things like that. Like, you get hit on. Often in restaurants, there's only one changing room because it was always all men. So there's not, like, a woman's locker room and a men's locker room. So you kind of learn to, like, change under your clothes or wait till everybody's gone. And I had, you know, various things where I would show up for an event, and because I was a woman, they'd think that my male sous chef with me must be the chef and I must be the sous chef.
Mm.
So I had to learn how to, you know, kind of straighten people out.
Did you ever get to the point that despite the fact that you love being a pastry chef because of this weird gender imbalance and all this stuff, that did you think, well, screw this, I'm actually going to run my own place, fund my own place, change it all up, and, you know, not be one part of the equation, but actually be the person in charge.
I, you know, that would make a nice story.
Yeah.
But I never felt the need to do that.
Okay.
And then what I ended up doing was I married a chef.
Yes.
And I was married to Rick Tremonto for 12 years. So, But we dated for a bunch of years. So we usually worked together at the same restaurant.
Right.
So he and I, you know, worked together for 15 or
so. You were essentially the co-person in charge. Yeah.
So I was, you know,
very much so.
I was like the, what is that thing where they say, like, behind every successful man is a brilliant or hardworking woman.
I'm not sure what
the woman is, but I was the one like writing all his recipes and doing all his food costs. And so doing a lot of the stuff that a chef would do, but not the leadership part. And I don't hunger to be that kind of leader. I think, you know, being a head chef requires wanting to manage lots of people.
Yes.
Orchestrate a lot of parts. I love the, you know, I love butter, sugar, flour, and eggs, which is why I wrote a book called that.
Yeah.
I love my ingredients. I like literally have, you know, sort of, I think they have personalities. I think, you know, chocolate wants to be center of the page. You know, they're like the funny guy in the room who always needs attention, whereas vanilla like is happy to, you know, just make everyone else look good and be in the background and just be like good underwear that kind of makes you look great. You know, vanilla makes everything else taste a little bit better.
Yeah.
So I feel like my ingredients really have like personalities, and I understand physics wise how they react off of each other, what, how they need each other and have dependency, and how they're consistent. So I actually, you know, found this area that I just find so interesting that I don't, I mean, I can, you know, make a killer chicken stock, or I can you know, fillet a sandwich, I can break down a hog, all that stuff.
Yeah.
I can do it and I'm good at it, but it's not what I dream about at night, and it's not what I seek out. I love desserts. And the sort of the part of dessert that I didn't realize was going to happen is you're someone who helps people celebrate.
Yeah.
So when someone has a birthday or someone has a wedding, you're the person that makes the final course of that celebration to mark that moment. Like I get to help people stop time and celebrate the fact that they beat cancer, or that they know who they want to marry, and they're going to ask them. And they give me the ring to put in a dessert.
Oh, my God.
So I'm, like, part of their engagement.
Yeah.
Or, you know, a family wants to celebrate because their son finally passed the bar exam after 3 tries.
Wow.
You know, those are the moments I get to be in people's lives for. Or, you know, he finally broke up with that girl and we never liked her anyway. And we go celebrate. So it's really a privilege to be that in people's lives. And as a pastry chef, I just find it so interesting that in our culture, that's how we choose to celebrate, is with dessert.
Mm.
And
maybe Prosecco or whatever.
Yeah,
I guess.
I get to be that guy who figures out what's the perfect dessert for you to mark this important moment in your life.
That's really cool. I want to ask you about working at True, but even working at a place like True. And we talked about this off the cuff earlier this weekend, about that this is a momentous meal, that it's going to cost you some bucks and the food is going to be on point, but the job of the people that run that place is that you need to know what's going on with that person's second cousin, and you need to know not just about their allergies, but about, you know what, they like this kind of chicken just a little bit more than that. They're just the little tiny things, and that even though you have a set menu, you're going to flourish it up for these people because it's a 6-table affair, a 10-table affair, or something like that. And it's going to be so precise and so specific. What is that like? Because the mental energy required, if you're just kind of slinging food, like, yes, there's a lot of mental energy, but you can go on autopilot a lot. Now you have to be right on point with the food, but you also have to have this mind meld with your customers, which does not exist at most restaurants, I think.
Right.
So what?
Which is probably why we could only be like an 80-seat restaurant, because I don't think we could do it with 300 covers.
Yeah,
a lot of it has to do with loving to nurture and take care of people.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like being a butler or, you know, being a concierge.
Interesting.
And you're just so interested in intimately, you know, or as intimate as you can, knowing your customers' preferences, where they like to sit, you know, when... I remember we took the Parmesan biscuits off the menu, and this one, I don't want to say their name. I'm like trying to keep myself from saying their name. This one family, they came in, they would eat there every I think it was like every Thursday night, they would come in. They were the greatest table. They'd come in like 5:30 when we opened. They'd order a degustation menu. Mm-hmm. It was her and her husband. And they'd order like an $800 bottle of wine.
Ooh.
And they were out by 6:30.
Oh, my goodness.
Like, it's the dream customer. You know, like, $1,000, you know, $500 check average per person.
Oh.
And doesn't even stay at their table past 6:30, so you can still use
you
it.
You can like turn it over four more times. Right,
well,
yeah.
two, restaurant. But, and we took the biscuits off, and she was upset. I had changed the bread, and she said, you know, if you don't bring those biscuits back, I'm not sure we're going to be coming back. And they went, you know, right back on the menu.
You bet.
Absolutely. But some of it is, you know, we literally would keep track of what, you know, what's what
index cards or whatever
ordered. Well, computers.
Yeah.
Luckily. What cocktails they ordered, what allergies, people had, you know, when their anniversary was. We had a thing where we were going to send anniversary cards to people because we had their anniversaries in the system.
Sure.
But then it was like, ooh, but what if they get divorced? Like, and we don't want to be the ones of like reminding them that, you know,
they're
not. So we couldn't do that one. But the restaurant True was sort of all about anticipating people's needs and wants before they even knew they had them.
Yeah.
That's
a great hotel,
our,
too, I guess.
What?
To do that kind of thing, to anticipate needs.
Right. And it's sort of, you know, that's what Michelin star service is about. Sort of anticipating, you know, serving you water before you even realize your glass was, you know, half empty.
Right.
Some of it, though, some of the ideas went a little overboard. Some of the ideas, like, we had purse stools next to every chair so women didn't have to put their purse
that's
on the back
great.
Of their chair. Well, the reason it's great is that you don't have to recover your chairs as often because they get really worn out from like a purse strap.
Wow.
Going on. So if you have a stool, it's just set. But then also like you can work out of it if you're a woman, like you can get your pen or you can get your glasses. So that was a great thing. And we had reading glasses for people who would, if we saw someone sort of rummaging around unsuccessfully, it was almost like the kind of tray a jeweler would have for diamonds, you know, like a black velvet tray.
This is amazing.
But we had like various reading glasses on it to present and you could pick a pair. But like one of them were nose glasses, you know.
Pince-nez.
To be funny. And like on the petit four card, have like Alka-Seltzer in one of the bowls, like to be funny. But my partner was like, no, that's going too far. And we had thought about having the valet like spray chocolate odor in your car when you get your car back, like it smells like chocolate.
Why didn't I eat at this
but
restaurant?
Then we realized like people might have allergies.
Yeah.
So some stuff you have to like think through a little extra.
Yeah.
But we always had, there was a little like giveaway that everyone went home with. It was like a little financier or Madeleine or something in a bag.
Okay.
Something they kept for a couple days because we realized that we're going to hand them this little thing. It's like, this is our goodbye kiss. And, you know, my hope is that like a good date, you know, it's there in the morning.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully you'll think back on what a great time you had with us. But we knew people would stick them in their pockets, forget about them for 3 days. And then like, oh, look, there's that thing from True.
Yeah.
So
it
had to be something that like kept well. So we, you know, that was just what we were doing at that time. We were trying to anticipate how to provide not only the best dining experience, but with a sense of humor.
Hmm.
There were a few really good fine dining restaurants in Chicago at that time.
Yeah.
You know, Charlie Trotter had been in existence for a while, and it sort of taught Chicago how to fine dine. But we also had Jean Blanchet, who was a chef from France, who cooked, you know, who was a colleague or a contemporary of, like, Alain Chappelle and Bocuse and all those guys. And he also sort of taught us about proper French service and fine dining. So it was like, you know, not that we had to do something different, but we realized, and this is when I say we as Rick, you know, my chef husband, and I realized that, and we had worked in England, we had worked in Europe, and we had eaten all over Europe, and we realized the more we spent on dinner, the less fun we had.
Oh.
And that just seemed like wrong. Like the food would be flawless.
Yeah,
you know,
you
go to Freddy Girardet and it's just, you know, perfection.
It's the best steak you've ever had or whatever.
Yeah. But also the most money you've ever paid for a meal. And like, and I really just didn't have that much fun. Like I kind of felt like I wasn't sure if I was using the right fork and I was nervous about this. And like, you know, did I draw? So we decided like we were going to do fine dining with a sense of humor.
Right.
And we were going to make fun of all those forks and, you know, all the place settings that are there and the, you know, six wine glasses and, you know, kind of make light of the fact that, you know, we understand it's a little much. So here's a grilled cheese sandwich, but like a really good one.
Yeah.
And it's really tiny and we'll charge you a lot for it. It was like, if, you know, the smaller things were, the more we could charge for
yes.
them. So it was a really fun experience. And I think we wanted to get it the most right you possibly could. That was what Rick and I were interested in doing. And we hired people who wanted to do that too. And they did it.
It feels like that was ahead of its time, because that's every good restaurant. If you go to Montreal, which is as good a restaurant, so it's phenomenal. You know, the standard bearer is Joe Beef, and you wear jeans, and it's very casual, but the food is extremely good, and it's fun. And there are a whole bunch of restaurants like that in every city now. And like,
we started a trend. Oh my God.
Yeah, like Lebec Fan per se, you know, these like, grand restaurants. Do people do that anymore? I feel like you have to be 70 to want to go to. If you have money and you're 45 years or 35 years old, that's not where you would go.
No,
you would go to
funny,
a Joe Beef kind of place.
Because that's what people recommend to me. And like, I have no interest in that kind of stuff. I'm not Joe Beef, but I have no interest in, like, you know, I went to Per Se, of course.
I'm
and
sure
I know
it was delicious.
And,
yeah,
but like, I don't really need that kind of, that style of dining in my life anymore.
Yeah.
And that wasn't, you know, what Rick and I were trying to do.
Right.
We were trying to acknowledge, like, I think I was, I don't know if you were here for lunch the other day when we did the BLTs. Like, part of one of my pilgrimages is I'm on the hunt for the best BLT in the country.
Wow.
Which, you know, it's not like I'm on the hunt for the best spinach souffle. I have this respect for everyday food,
mm-hmm.
but done really well.
Yes.
So for me, you know, we were sort of incorporating some of that into True's menu and, you know, kind of glorifying things that hadn't been glorious in, you know, decades,
yeah.
but, you know, but are important culturally, and are delicious, you know, and we can just put that on some marble and now it's fine dining, you know, and use really good brioche and use, you know, killer full epi cheese and
yeah.
you know, things like that.
So cookbooks, this idea of, okay, well, I'm going to put this out there for the world. Not everybody's a writer. Is it just you achieve a certain milestone, you're famous enough, you have to write cookbooks? Do you have an inner drive to do cookbooks? Is it, oh, I need to share my gift with the world? How does one decide to not only do one, but just continue on and become prolific at that kind of
thing? And do eight of them.
Eight of them.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things is I flunked typing. We talked about that.
Yes, already. Right.
So, and dyslexia. So I have sort of, you know, two little strikes against me there.
Do you use a dictation software or anything?
No, I don't. But and initially why we wrote our first book, I did it with Rick.
Rick, yeah.
I mean, I mostly did it with Julia Moskin, who was our writer,
yep.
who now writes for the New York Times. So we're not allowed to write with her anymore.
No.
Because of non-competes. But
yeah.
Julia and I did most of it. You know, we would watch Rick cook and write down what he did, things like that. But it was really Rick, honestly, who wanted a book.
Okay.
You know, all our friends had books. You know, Bobby Flay had a book.
Yeah.
Everyone else had a book. And so Rick sort of was looking around and he wanted a book too. And Bobby was nice enough to introduce us to his agent,
That's
Jane
cool.
Distel in New York. And it was funny though, we went to Jane and we had already been known for, we had a restaurant called Trio,
mm-hmm.
which was fine dining and fancy pants before we had True.
Mm-hmm.
Trio was like in 93. So we were doing this very visual food. It was in like Wine Spectator magazine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were getting some national acclaim. We had gotten top 10 best new chefs from Food and Wine magazine, which Julia Child gives you that award. And that was part of how I met Julia. And
jeez,
got
we're going
to
talk about
write
that.
And work
yeah.
with her. But after a couple of years, Rick wants a book and we go to, we meet up with Jane in New York, and she's like, okay, what do you got? You know, she's real New York. She's like, what do you got? You know, give me a pitch me.
Mm-hmm.
We're like, well, we have this fine dining restaurant, and we played on marble and glass, and she's like, what else you got? You know? We're like, well, we're opening a brasserie in, 6 months, but it's not really open yet. She's like, yeah, tell me more. I can sell that maybe. What's that?
Mm-hmm.
We're like, well, you know, it's like chicken and shoestring potatoes, you know, roast chicken, shoestrings, potatoes, goat cheese. She's like, yeah, I think I can sell that. Okay, we'll do that.
Mm.
And like, we had to sort of write a proposal for a restaurant that didn't exist yet.
Right. And food. And that, it's actually a book proposal.
Food that hadn't been born yet.
Wow.
So that was sort of, you know, my dad, like, oh, just, you have to just be eight lessons ahead of your students. And, you know, we write a, she introduces us to a young editor, Julia Moskin, who just wants to write. You know, actors who just want to direct. And we give Julia her first gig. And that's one of the smartest things we ever did, was like, find someone who wants to be something and help facilitate that, and they will be so loyal.
Yeah.
Because you help them, like, you know, get out of the hood or whatever it is you're helping them do. So we had a great time writing that first book. And by the time it came out, the restaurant was open.
Yeah.
And successful. It was called Brasserie Tea. And I think once we wrote that, we, what happened was there, like, wasn't enough room really for all the desserts that I wanted to do. So this next book was, I think the next book was Butter, Sugar, Flour, Eggs.
Mm.
And it was an all pastry book, an all dessert book. And, you know, Rick, like, drove me to the post office or whatever, but he didn't really do anything.
No, that's
your book. Which is fine.
Yeah.
But his name was on the cover because we were like this chef couple. And I think we got to be on a couple of Food Network shows, like, to promote both of those books.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of how the Food Network thing started, was just, you know, you go on book, that used to be when there was book tour.
Book junkets, there, book tours.
Yeah, there used
Let's
to
go to Columbus.
Budget for book tour.
Oh, yes.
I mean, I had to go to Canada. I went to Vancouver once for one of my books, which was cool. But you used to go on book tour.
Yeah.
And do, you know, 7 morning television shows and all this stuff. So, so the books kind of, those two kind of happened that way. And then I think what happened next, let me think. Oh, we opened True, and I had all these little desserts that I was doing on the Petit Four cart, and it was like, oh, that's a book. You know, you kind of see something and be like, that could be a book, the way you hear a story and be like, ooh, that could be a movie.
Yeah.
You know, that's how it was. And then I got my TV show on Food Network.
Yeah.
So with my show, we would tape 30 shows at a time, which have 3 recipes per show.
Yeah.
So that's 90 recipes I need to do.
Double dipping, you know what you're doing.
So it's like, okay, you know, we sort of pick themes that I already had recipes for, but maybe I had like 2 out of the 3, and the third one I had to like write a new one. And by the time I was done with the 90 recipes, 45 were from books that already existed, and 45 were new recipes. I'm like, oh, there's half of my new book.
Oh, wow.
So it would like write itself.
Mm-hmm.
And become the, you know, I had a book half written, so now I just got to write the second half. So they just kind of like rolled out that way. It wasn't, you know, a big plot or, a design or a goal or anything like that, which I feel bad saying that, you know.
That's okay.
There was no rubrics, or it wasn't charted out or anything. It was just kind of, it's sort of every 2 years I seem to write one, though I haven't in the last like 5 years. But up until Gail Gann's Lunch, I had written a book, like, I think every 2 years. Mm. And the last two were savory, kind of. I did Gail Gann's Brunch and Gail Gann's Lunch.
Yeah.
And that was when I sort of was experimenting with, like, okay, like, will people accept me as more than just a pastry chef?
Yeah.
And I was actually cooking as a chef at that time, I was a chef in residence at this organic historic farm.
Okay.
That grew all this stuff, and my job was to, like, cook with the stuff, and then they sold it at their farmer's market.
Mm.
And the pay was really shitty, so I was like, what can I do to supplement my pay? I know I'll teach some classes here, and we'll charge a lot for that. And so the combo was like a really sustainable gig, and fun, and near my house, and a beautiful setting. And to this day, I still teach the classes there. I teach there like once or twice a month for the big bucks, but don't do the like bad hourly rate stuff. But I wasn't sure if people were okay with me not being just a pastry chef.
Right.
So the first book was the Gail Gann's Brunch that was not sweets or desserts, which is in, like, I think it's in 5th printing now. It did really well, is the point of that. And I found out, like, oh, okay, they'll let me out of the cake box, and I can, you know, be respected and seen as someone people want to learn from in other parts of the kitchen as well. So that was kind of a nice, freeing thing.
We're talking here in Cooperstown, and one of the speeches I enjoyed a lot at the induction was of Chipper Jones. Mm-hmm. Chipper Jones is a great ball player, and Chipper Jones talked about meeting Mickey Mantle and how he was a prospect at that time. He hadn't established himself, but he was obviously very talented. He was the number one pick in the draft. Chipper Jones went on to become a Hall of Famer. So you mentioned meeting Julia Child. Is it the same kind of thing? Is it, here's this titan of industry, teach me, oh my God? Or is it, oh, that's cool, like, let's chit-chat. Like, were you starstruck? Was it, I need to learn as much as possible from this person? What was that encounter like?
Well, I think the first time I met her, she was, like, on a panel discussion at a, like, a food and wine conference I was at.
Okay.
And I remember asking her, you know, I'm, for some reason, like, when 17 people raise their hand, I'm the one that gets called on.
Huh.
And I know that. Like, I know that's coming and I can feel it. You know, when there's a magician on stage and he's looking for a volunteer and 50 people raise their hand, I always get picked.
Huh.
So I knew my question would, you know, I'd get called on. And I remember my question to her was, I asked her, you know, why is it and that with people like you, the only way we can have your food is we have to make it ourselves. Like, why didn't you ever have a restaurant?
That's a good question.
And she said, oh, I'm way too smart to have a restaurant and they're way too much trouble. And I think that was before I had restaurants.
Yeah.
And I was sort of like checking with the elders, you know, of like, is this a good idea? Which it's a terrible idea.
So you ignored her advice completely. Yeah.
Completely right.
Yeah.
And that's who goes into the restaurant business, is people who like can't help themselves but do it. You know, after all the good advice and authorities have been, you know, consulted, they still go against what people say. So that was sort of the first time I like met her a little bit. But the real time was when I was getting my Top 10 Best New Chefs award.
Yeah.
From Food and Wine, and she gives out the award. And the night before you get your award, she would hold court at the Jerome, it's, you know, Food and Wine Classics in Aspen, Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
So she would hold court at the Jerome Hotel where we were all staying to meet, like, the young, you know, it's like that scene in the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer cartoon where, like, all the young bucks are trying out for Santa. So we'd all be sitting in a circle, and she'd go around the circle and be like, you know, tell me about yourself and what's your background and, you know, where'd you go to school? And mm-hmm. She was always really interested and a really good listener. Mm. Wanted to know everybody's story, wanted to connect. She was great at that. And when she got to me, and it was me and Rick, so
yeah.
There were 11 top 10 best new chefs that year, because we were a chef couple.
Correct.
So she got to me, and she said, you know, oh, dearie, where did you learn to cook? You know, and I'm like, well, you know, I'm mostly self-taught. She goes, oh, never say you're self-taught. Always say you learned in the field. And I was like, oh, okay, I learned in the field. I went to La Varenne for like 2 summers, but I didn't have a degree or, you know, I wasn't one of these kids that went to CIA.
The other CIA, unfortunately.
And then she looks at Rick. She's like, what about you, dearie? He's like, oh, I'm self-taught too. And she like hits him so hard in the arm. She like slaps him in the arm. She's like, what did I just tell you? And he's like, I mean, I learned in the field. And it's funny because if you ever meet Rick, he's a big guy.
Yeah.
He's like a 300-pound big guy.
Okay.
And the idea of like Julia Child rocking on him and scaring him and like, oh, you know, like kind of making him stutter was sort of funny. So that was when we first met her. And then later that year was when I get that call. I'm just like in my kitchen, my pastry kitchen at Trio, and the phone rings and I'm like, hello, pastry. And on the other line is like, hello, dearie, this is Julia Child calling. And you're thinking like, really? Like, do you have to say who you, like, everybody knows that voice. You don't really have to say who you are. And then she goes, I want to know if you want to be in my new book, Baking with Julia. As if, like, is it?
No,
like,
sorry, I'm busy.
Right,
yeah,
like,
no, I'm not available.
Let me think about that. Yeah. I don't know. So I'm like, oh, of course, you know, of course, Julia, yeah. I'd love to. So it turns out that Julia doesn't really bake, and she's writing a book called Baking with Julia. So she called us the 27 Voices. We were the 27 Voices from across the country who contributed recipes to her book. And we each had our own chapter.
Okay.
And if you got your recipes in on time to Dori Greenspan, who was writing the book, she was the book writer at the time, who also, like, she writes Pierre Hermé's books, who's a, you know, fantastic French pastry chef, and now writes her own books and is a pastry chef in her own right. If you get your recipes into Dori on time, you get to come to Cambridge and go to her house and tape the show for PBS.
Oh, wow.
And be on TV.
Oh, wow.
And I had never really been on TV much. I mean, at that point, I think I'd done one book. No, I don't think I'd done any. So I'm, like, not even media trained at this point.
Are you scared? Are you...
So I'm not scared because I've done a lot of demos.
Right.
And so I had that one demo.
Also,
where,
Expo
like,
67.
I turned completely, you know, blazing red and then I can't talk because my mouth is so dry,
okay,
like that first time. And then it never happened to me again.
Uh-huh.
So I turn in my recipes and then I get to go to Cambridge, which is like going to Santa's house,
mm-hmm,
right? You're going to Julia Child, and it's just what you want it to be. It's like this old Victorian, you know, kind of dusty house. It's four stories and... oddly, her kitchen is not great. Like, if I was her, I would so have, like, the uber kitchen, right? But it's, like, it's an island. It's got sort of a crappy old oven. And, I mean, it's fine. But the iconic, I don't know how much you know about Julia, but she had this pegboard where all her pots and pans were hung, and her husband, Paul, drew an outline around each pan so every day they could go back into the right place, and like that iconic pegboard was there, and just like it's all there.
Wow.
And when you go for 3 days. And what it is the first day you're just kind of adjusting and, you know, making sure that she's got the equipment you need and that like your mise en place is somewhere, like there's ingredients there for you. And then the second day you prep all your stuff and you watch whoever's taping that day.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third day you tape. And someone else is watching you. And it was kind of that 3-day cycle that she just kept going through. But I remember when I first got there, I'm in the basement, I'm kind of looking around to see if she's got, you know, what kind of rolling pin does she have and blah, blah, blah. And she comes flying down the stairs and she's like, oh, she always called me Deary, which implied she did not remember my name. But later a book came out that's called Oh, Deary.
Yes.
I guess she called everyone Deary. She's like, oh, Deary, I just can't wait to work with you tomorrow. And she had given me the phyllo chapter. So all my desserts were made with phyllo. She goes, I can't wait to work with you tomorrow to work with phyllo, whatever you call that stuff. And I said, well, Julia, you know, certainly you've worked with phyllo before. No, no, dearie, I just can't wait tomorrow to learn about it from you.
Whoa.
And I have this moment where I'm like, did I just hear that? Did Julia Child just say she can't wait to learn about phyllo, whatever you call that stuff, from me? From me? And, you know, it's like that you will have this moment. You've had it, the moment, where, like, you're somebody's kid, and then you're like, oh, my God, I'm somebody's dad.
Yeah.
Or, like, you were employee, and then, like, oh, my God, I'm the boss. Like, when did that happen? So I had that with Julia Child. And so I'm a little bit... You know, I'm kind of freaked out. And go watch the shows. They're darling.
Mm-hmm.
They're darling. Like I said, it's before I media trained.
Yeah.
So I'm soft-spoken.
Yeah.
I'm like
no good.
Demure. Yeah. I'm terribly blonde. my eyes, before the Food Network got a hold of my eyebrows, so they're like massive, Muriel eyebrows. And I'm 5 feet tall, and Julia is not.
No, she's not.
You know, she's like... Normally, like 5'11", I think, or 6 feet. Thank God she had scoliosis, so she was like 5'10". But it's this Mutt and Jeff thing. And, you know, with TV, like, if there's a lot of disparity this way or this way, you know, it doesn't make the best TV.
I'm 6'4", I'm aware
right,
of this.
Right, so you run into that all the time.
Yeah.
And what she said before we went on camera, she says to me, now, dearie, if you're talking too much, I'll stick my thumb in your thigh. Which is, like, so perfect, because it's, like, gender neutral.
Yeah.
You know, it's under counter, it's off camera.
Yeah.
She goes, after all, it is my show.
Fantastic.
And two things. Go watch the show, and you'll see how ridiculous that statement was, only because, like, I barely speak. I'm just so, like, little sweet granddaughterish in the show. And I tried to figure out later, like, why did she say that? And her show that she had done before this one was called Jacques and Julia. So it was with Jacques Pepin.
Yeah, right.
And Jacques just railroad, like, just steals the whole show. He's so chatty. And she's kind of, she's, you know, 84 at the time and kind of can't get a word in. So she's determined to, like, have this be her show, even though she's not cooking.
Yeah.
We're doing all the cooking. She's like, she told us her job was to be, like, anticipate what the audience at home might be wondering and ask that. Mm. Like, oh, was that a quarter cup or a half a cup? Like, that was her job. And it was, you know, before the internet, so you couldn't, like, everything changed when the internet happened. We used to have to give quantities on camera.
Yeah.
And then later, as I get a show on the Food Network, they're like, don't give quantities, because they want to drive people to the website.
Oh.
Right, so you have to, like, relearn how to do your recipes. But when we first start on camera, I'm, like, really far away from her, because I don't want to get the thumb in the thigh. So I'm, like, arms, which makes terrible TV, you know, to be,
no,
like,
it's a two-shot, you got
to
be on camera.
Yeah, you got to be, like, shoulder to shoulder, overlapping, practically. Yeah. So it's kind of funny, like, you'll watch, you know, me sort of, like, the director was clearly, like, doing this, and, you know, move together. And it actually went so well, I got to do two episodes, which most people only to do one. So that was very nice. So that was, you know, some of the meeting with Julia. There's lots of Julia stories, but I don't think we have time for for all of those. But it was a great experience. The thing is, when we were done taping both shows, you know, the director yells, cut, you know, wrap, you know, I got what I need. And I start crying. I start crying and they're like, What's wrong? Like, do we have to retake the last, you know, segment? Or, like, what's the matter? I'm like, no, you don't understand. I'm like, you know, like, what? I'm like, nothing. It's just, it's over. And, like, I spent all year saying, you know, when I go to Julia's and when Julia and I cook and this, and, like, what will I talk about now? And now that I've taught Julia Child about filofilo, whatever you call that stuff, like, what do you do next?
Life,
like,
is all downhill from here.
Like, I have to go, like, stock groceries in a grocery store or something, like, or go be a bookkeeper. Like, what do you do after that? Yeah. And I couldn't figure out, like, what else is there when you've done that?
Yeah, you've hit the
I peaked at such a young age. Yeah. And, I mean, the sweet thing is, you know, we didn't know the Food Network was coming.
Yes.
But it, you know,
at the time, you think is the pinnacle.
Right. And, you know, there was plenty more. And I have this funny thing where, like, I sort of don't even set goals because I realize that I can't really sort of dream as big as how quickly opportunities reveal themselves to us. So, and, you know, you get asked that in interviews. I'm like, what's your 5-year goal? I'm like, none. Because if I had said to you, you know, or the, you know, give me a 5-year, 10-year, 20-year. So if I had said to you in, you know, 1999 that I want to have 8 books, 2 James Beard Awards, TV show on the Food Network that runs for 10 years, a root beer company. You know, like, you would have been like, you have balls. Like, none of that's going to happen for you.
And, or you're meant to, or excuse you're me, mentally mental. Ill. Yeah, right.
So, and those are all the things that happened.
Yeah.
So had I called them out, I mean, yes, the universe probably would have brought them a little sooner had I called them out. But, like, I don't have the gumption to say that's, you know, I can't even dream that big. Like, who knew that all that stuff was going to be available? So I just kind of, like, say thank you and, you know, answer all my emails and try to return all my phone calls and, you know, just keep up with what keeps being given to me. And I'm just grateful. You know, I try to send a thank you note to Food Network every year because I feel like my career has probably gone on much longer than it should have.
Mm.
But I, you know, I'll go to, like, Minneapolis and do a cooking demo and hundreds of people show up.
Because you had a show.
Because I had a show.
Yeah.
When I got canceled.
Yeah.
I sent a thank you note of, like, this was great. You know, thank you so much for giving me this show. It changed everything. It, you know, it doubled my book sales. I had butts in seats in my restaurants every night. And the most important thing is it paid, and I cry when I talk about this, but it paid for my kid's college.
Gee.
It paid for Gio's college.
Wow.
Like, that was how I built a 529 account. And my kid is not a kid who has to apply for FAFSA or needs to get out loans or is going to be burdened with loans when he finishes school. And I got him a t-shirt. I had it made that says Food Network paid for my college.
Oh my God.
And, like, gave him to him as he was going, you know, freshman year when I dropped him off at College of Worcester. And I wrote a thank you note again saying, you know, I can't thank you enough for all this. And my kid's going to college on Food Network. And I want to remind you that I've got these twin girls whose 529 account is not loaded up. Don't have the college money yet, so I've got another show. That would be really awesome. But, you know, it's like life-changing. And I just feel very fortunate. And I feel guilty. There's like sort of survivor guilt. Maybe you have that when, like, you're the guy that got the show. Like,
yeah.
I'm like, why me? Like, I have friends that work way harder or, you know, we all work 16-hour days. Yes, my parents sprung for braces, you know, and John Hogan's parents didn't. So he's got bad teeth. And, you know, Jacques Therese is a terrific pastry chef. But I got the first Food Network show of all desserts and all pastries because I didn't have a French accent and I could be understood.
Huh.
I got the show because I was comfortable on camera.
Yeah.
Unlike other chefs, because my dad threw me up on stage as a kid all the time. So I had a bunch of skills. Apparently, you know, when they were looking for Food Network hosts, they were looking for people who were comfortable on camera.
Mm-hmm.
People who could teach. And people who could actually cook. Like, you needed those three things.
Yeah.
And I guess to find all three in someone was rare.
Yeah.
You know, there are people who can cook really great, but they can't explain what they're doing. Or once they start explaining, their hands stop moving. And when you only have 22 minutes to get through three recipes, like, that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Or someone who can teach, but, you know, is so uncomfortable on camera.
No charisma.
Yeah, and just can't connect.
Yeah.
Can't connect with their peeps, you know, with their audience, or can't feel their audience on the other side of the camera, which we talked about a little bit.
Yeah.
So I'm the girl that gets that, you know, and I, like, I have a why me moment, but it's, you know, a positive why me, like, why me? Why am I, and I'm just the luckiest girl in the world is all I can figure out. But I sometimes, you know, feel bad that, like, my other friends, my ex-husband,
yeah,
you know, who's a really talented chef, didn't get a show, you know, and it's probably part of what broke us up. Like, as a woman in the industry, I was considered more interesting because it was like, ooh, a woman. Like, who cares about a male chef? That's common, but ooh, a female in the kitchen. So I would get a lot of attention because I was the minority. I was the Jew. I was the, you know, I was older than everybody else. I was short. You know, I was an art student who flipped, you know, over to cooking. I had all these sort of unique things that brought attention to me, and it was hard, I think, on my chef husband at the time. You know, not everybody gets a show. Hmm. And, I mean, do you have some of that?
Well, a little bit. Actually, the thing that got me, what you were saying, was what happens if you reach a pinnacle. My goal when I was a kid, I subscribed to Sports Illustrated when I was 8, and I was like, I think I want to write for Sports Illustrated one day. And then I did.
And then you did.
But the cool thing is, now I don't know what I want to be when I grow up. I'm in my 40s. Maybe I'll never know. Great. So maybe then your next thing, you're going to be 75 and you're going to have your thing. And just to kind of wrap up the conversation and bring it home, you talked about the survival guilt or whatever, like, I'm some guy, whatever, and I have not reached any pinnacle or whatever, but I've had some modicum of success and it's really great. And there are other people who've maybe better, maybe harder working, and they possibly should be ahead or whatever. So what can you do? You have stories like Jessica the intern, and you try to lift other people up as best as you can. If somebody comes to you and says, can you help me out with something? You try to take 5 or 10 minutes, and you can, and you do the best that you can, and you appreciate that your kids benefit from this and that you just try not to be an asshole about it. And that's all you can do. And I don't put my status in my field anywhere near the status in your field, but I think that's what you do is you just, okay, so I got something good. Let me go help other people so they can get something good. And then there is no guilt and everybody's happy and everybody wins, right? I mean, it seems that way.
And yet we still feel
guilty. Well.
A little bit. But yeah, I think you're probably right.
Well, Gail, this has been a pleasure, and I enjoyed talking to you off podcast, and I love that we were able to talk in exactly the same way on podcast. Not that I'm any bit surprised, and thank you.
Thanks for asking me. I appreciate it.